This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's talk about this case. Lindsay Clancy's jury is now seated. 18 people who now have to answer one question nobody agrees on. Was a mother who was on 13 psychiatric medications criminally responsible when she killed her three children? Both sides agree she did it. That's not the debate. The fight is over whether she was sane. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, joins myself and retired FBI special agent Robin Drake. I want to start here because I know, Jen, we have somewhat differing opinions on this, but I want to kind of understand how a jury is going to get anywhere with this, especially 18 people. Prosecution thinks it's super simple. She checked Apple Maps to calculate how long her husband would be gone and allegedly strangled all three children in the window that she created, then jumped out a window and survived as part of an evil plan. Completely omitting the part about begging for help countless times from countless physicians, being misprescribed, misdiagnosed over and over, and being on a cocktail of meds that would give nearly anyone who took them psychosis, with one doctor not knowing what the other is doing and failing her at every turn. Both parts are actually true in that story. Both sides seem to have people who refuse to see things from others' perspectives. It goes down to what was she thinking at that moment in time? Was it an evil conspiracy, or was it a reflection of being on that many drugs? I mean, how are you going to get 18 jurors on the same page here? Do you think we do, Jen?
I think it's going to be really tough. I mean, as they say, any good attorney will tell you that the case is decided at voir dire.
Yeah.
That's where it's decided. It's not decided in the courtroom. And when you look at the people I want, if I want an acquittal, I am going to look for a 40 to 50-year-old woman. Mm-hmm. I want them up on that jury. I want somebody who's had postpartum, somebody who, you know, is taking whatever pills they're on to make them feel better, that the court may never know about.
Yeah.
And that's who I want on, somebody that's going to have an empathy, empathetic guy who, you know, if I'm the defense. Now, if I'm the prosecution, oh my gosh, I want that. I want guys, I want blue collar guys that think, you know, women on drugs and all of that, and that you should love your children. And then I want Catholics, I want Mormons, I want, you know, the real right side of biblical theology sort of on there. I don't know how you find that cross section that would meet, that not one person is going to sneak past on either side. What
yeah.
do you think?
Yeah.
You know what I think? I mean, both sides, the context of both sides are so strong. They really are. You can see both sides. And I think that is such a challenge. Like you said, you know, we've been saying the last couple of days, you know, likelihood of a hung jury is high. But you know what I think it's going to come down to is, and people are saying it in the comments too, just talking about the Guthrie case, it's going to come down to human beings. I think, because if you remove a lot of things from this on the science side, it's going to come down to, I think, is there congruence? Because we're always looking for congruence with the behaviors of human beings. Because if people and events and what's being reported is incongruent, it allows us to feel creepy, that there's something wrong, there's deception, there's manipulation at play. So I think it's going to really come down to her presence in the courtroom and the husband's presence in the courtroom, because they have presented, and defense is going to be presenting this narrative of a mother, caring wife, loving mother, children, I'm nurse. I mean, all these things are the arc they've painted, and how incongruent this behavior was it? And they're blaming the doctors, the prescriptions, the 13 drugs, psychotic event. So I think what the jurors are going to be looking for, what I'd be looking for is what I'm seeing in a courtroom congruent with which story? Mm-hmm. That's what they're going to be looking for. And they're going to be looking for that congruence, not just from her first, the husband, the family. You know, what are we seeing when we see her? Which story holds water based on what they are seeing? Because that's what it comes to. I know they're going to get their instructions. I know it's going to be very technical. They're going to want to follow this. But as 18 human beings look at another human being, I think they're going to look for which story is actually most congruent from what I'm being presented as a human being.
12 women, 6 men is how it plays out. That is what has been decided. And The trial is about to begin. Patrick Clancy, her husband, her ex-husband now, is on both the prosecution and the defense witness list. And the prosecution is allegedly going to be calling him first. We'll see if they do. He's the one who's also filed a malpractice lawsuit against her doctors, told a reporter he wasn't married to a monster. He was married to a woman who got sick and publicly forgave her. I mean, how does calling him first not blow up in the prosecution's face? Why do you think they're calling him first, Jen?
Oh, I want to always call that problem witness first. I don't want to have the defense do it. I want to put it out there that, listen, I know about this. We know that, you know, his thoughts on this that don't align necessarily with ours. And you get him up and you get him out as quick as you can. You limit your examination so that the defense is limited. And you move on, and then you cover that scab. I'll just say, not that he's a scab, but, you know, in your prosecution, you cover that up then with all the other information. In other words, that becomes a memory in the past. I'd put him on probably number two or something like that, three. He's not my, you know, he's not my opening hitter. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. But I need to bury him somewhere between two and three or so. And then have a lot of witnesses after him.
It's also interesting, too. I'd be curious what both Eric Faddis and Bob Mata say about this as attorneys. As a human behavior guy, if they're putting on first, what I'd be hopeful as a reason why they do it is that if he's likable, if he's believable, if he's compelling, he can actually potentially set up 18 people for their positive confirmation bias for whatever comes next as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to really watch how they question him and how they go through it. I mean, that's going to be a big part of this, because this is such a personal story to people.
Yeah.
And this is something where the stakes are so high and such horrendous things happened here. Three children are not with us because of this. So that's going to be key, the approach. You're going to have to be a likable DA on this. You're going to have to be a very likable person on the prosecution if you're going to want that jury to go along with you. Same with the defense. I mean, it's going to have to not be any, you know, you don't want to be operating out of a crematorium, to put it nicely. It's not going to fly. She was prescribed 13 different psychiatric medications in 4 months. Zoloft, Prozac, Klonopin, Seroquel, Valium, Ambien, just to name a few of tasting the rainbow. Her husband told the doctors she turned into a zombie. If the medical system threw that many drugs at her and she broke, does the prosecution just pretend the medications don't matter? I mean, Jen, how do they tell this story and omit one of the most important parts to it? Or how do they downplay that as if it doesn't matter? I mean, how do you think they're going to try and do that to get a jury to not see 13 different meds in 4 months as the clear reason her brain broke?
Well, I think you got to look at the fact. You can be prescribed 13 meds, but what were you really taking? What were you
13
really
meds.
Missing? Were you, did you try one? Did anybody do, as far as I know, no one did any sort of tox on her. So there's no tox, there's no blood tox, there's nothing. All you have is somebody that was prescribed 13 meds, but nobody knows what was in her when she did that, to my knowledge. Nobody did tox on her.
Fair
so
point.
When
so
you
it's,
have
it's,
that
yeah,
fact,
it's the
that
absence
could be,
of
yeah, she tried
yeah,
this
yeah,
one. And,
yeah. Going yeah. So basically,
that's
from a prosecution standpoint, go with the absence of information if they don't have it. And that's a big if. If that's not available, that is a big if. That could, because you got to prove it is. It's up to the prosecution in this case to prove that she was not in her right mind. That's the burden that falls on them in this, the way this case is set up. So that I could see that being a boon. Robin, what are your thoughts?
Well, and to creative Chaosify, I think I finally got her name right. And Siobhan covered it this week as well. You know, with the 13 meds, that's one angle of it. But Siobhan Scott covered it as our psychotherapist as well. You know, this actually, psychotic and psychotic breaks like this is also genetic and runs in families. And so I think you have the medical side from the toxicology side from all the different meds and doctors not talking to each other and communicating like they're supposed to be doing. So that's a one angle that fell off. So whether they can prove she took the meds or not, the protocols weren't followed to actually keep her safe from herself and those things. Plus, I think you have, and that's what will come out in the trial, is the fact of the other medical side is it's a family history potentially of the genetic side of the psychotic break that happened. Because again, because according to what I was getting from Siobhan the other day, this psychotic break could have happened regardless of the meds, because she is already suffering from postpartum from the other child, you know, that she had earlier. And so having a psychotic break postpartum, I can't remember all the technical terms on this, but it could be completely irrespective of the meds that she was on. It still could have happened regardless. So I think that's what they're going to be hanging it on as well.
It'll be interesting.
I wanted to mention too, I was trying to think of how many cases and think of three breaks.
Oh, she left us hanging.
I think she's the mountains of Transylvania are just going by Dracula's castle right now, and it's not. Oh, was that? Did we just lose her?
We lost her. Yep, she's gone.
Oh, she went through the tunnel.
The tunnel. Yeah. I'm not kidding. She's on a train over there. Like, why? I don't know.
I thought last week in Germany was pretty interesting. And then this week it was.
It's a Coffin Daffer world tour this week, I guess.
Are you back, Jen? Are you there?
Yeah, I am. I was just going to say, these people can't plan, at least when I've seen them. I know everybody's different, and I think that's going to be the main thing the prosecution hangs their hat on. I do agree with Robin. It's going to be a big, you know, looking at the humanity side of it, looking at how they're acting. But the other thing is, can they show the planning? Can they show text messages? Can they show, if they can show planning, that really puts a huge hole in, you know, this psychotic break that she just went after him. No, because she planned it. And I think that is where the prosecution could win this case.
But someone can be in an active psychosis for days, for weeks, for months, and cognitively plan shit. That doesn't mean like, snap, and now I'm completely delusional and acting like a crazy lunatic monster. That what you're describing is could very easily be someone who is suffering from active psychosis for a period of time. That doesn't negate it out.
Yeah, it's going to be up to the defense.
Well, and that's where the experts are going to come in.
Yeah. It's after the children.
The psychologists and psychiatrists.
Yeah, yeah. And just seeing how well they can educate a jury on it and seeing how they're gonna take it. After the children died, she was intubated in a hospital bed and used an erasable whiteboard to write the words, "Do I need a lawyer?" That's another thing that we're going to see the prosecution, I'm sure, bring up. In understanding a psychotic break or psychosis or someone suffering in and out of it, it is, you do go in and out of it. Understanding it doesn't make that in like a horrible, premeditated, I know exactly what I'm doing sort of thing. It's just kind of par for the course of someone that's going through something that horrible. I mean, could it look like someone who's premeditated something? Sure. But when you have all the evidence of other things going on and all the meds going on, I, it's about educating the jury and seeing what they will accept and what they won't accept. But how do you think that will read in general, Jen?
Well, I think it's critical that whoever has the best expert when it comes to the psychotic break, that is going to be probably who wins the day. That, to me, and the fact they can show the steps that were taken before, during, and after. And by the way, I'm sorry, the hospitalization took place exactly right after.
Mm-hmm.
if it took place exactly right after, they should have a full toxicology on exactly what she had in her at the time.
Well, I mean, that could be, if there wasn't much, it could be damning if they're going to go down the road of medications. But if they do have it and it's just a cacophony of everything, I mean, that may also save the day. So you're right. They probably should have it. But it's going to depend on what they tested for, too. Did they test for every, and what shows up in that window? What did they do at that moment? So that will be key. And we just don't know the answer at this moment in time. Robin, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I just keep looking at, I always look at intent on things. And again, I always focus on behavior arcs, and her behavior arc prior to this event is so solid. It's so congruent. And then it begs the question for me that I think prosecution, even if, and I think defense is going to have to do this, get the expert psychiatrist up there and say how psychotic breaks do can span periods of time. They can look normal. We're having people comment on it. We're commenting on it. It's not just like a, okay, there are going to be a psychotic break for like 20 minutes. No, this could go on for a couple of days. That's what they're going to have to explain. But also part of this is, what could she possibly have gained if she was in her right mind by killing her kids? Literally, I mean, so when you're looking at all these cases we cover, it's like, you know, you can always look back to the motivation. They're going for insurance money. They're going because of the jilted lover. They're going because they're going for child custody issues. There's all these different things that they can show intent. Other than them saying that, you know, the prosecution saying she showed pre-planning, for what outcome? Literally, what outcome other than a psychotic break could she possibly? And that's why I think they're going to have to answer to, because me as a human being sitting on this, if she's congruent in that courtroom with someone who had a psychotic break, who has a lot of remorse, who's willing to own up to what she did, and the husband's able to be congruent too, the other argument that I, in my mind, they have to overcome is, what would be the intent of this? I mean, you know, it's not like she's going to get away with it. Well, she wasn't trying to get away with it. What was the gain she got from doing it? I mean, she gave no leakage from what we see of saying, my life would be better without my kids. I mean, see what I mean? I mean, there's a lot to overcome, I think, when it comes to a narrative.
Yeah, I would agree. Listener question here, and I want to throw it to you, Jen, before we wrap up. Do you think she should take the stand?
Mm-hmm. That's always dicey. If I'm a prosecutor, I say, yeah, get her up there.
Yeah.
Defense, please. But as a defense attorney, there is no way I'm going to turn her loose on the stand. I still want to know, I really want to know what is in the text messaging, other communications to whatever, mom, best friend, sister, a confidant. I want to know if she ever acted burdened. In other words, we all can see what she wanted to show from the outside window pane, what was really going on inside. And I tell you, if the prosecution has information that she is, you know, hated her kids and is burdened and wanted life without them, that's going to be a big problem for the defense. That's an if.
Totally agree. And that's why we live in the world of maybe. As for what we're seeing from the outside, that's what they have to overcome. But they might have the digital evidence to say that she saw her kids as a burden. And it was not just for the couple days prior to this thing or whatever it is. But, you know, this was spanning a period of time, maybe from the first child, you know, to the second or third. Who knows? But that's what I think is the human side that they have to overcome.
Be interesting to see if she does. I've never seen her speak. So without seeing that, I mean, the way someone reads would be extremely important to answering that question. Whether or not, you know, they could totally sell their story is a huge thing. Some people are just not that effective at doing that, even if they're completely speaking from the heart. So I don't know the answer to that either. I think we'll have to kind of weigh that as it gets a little bit closer and further into the trial. It would be fascinating. The fact that the husband and Patrick is doing it there, that does say a lot and probably will be the most powerful witness of the entire trial. But we'll see. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts as this case begins. We're going to be bringing you trial audio every single day on our podcast channels. So Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, wherever. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Press subscribe. You'll get the trial audio there. And on YouTube, you'll get our analysis of it every single day as well. So you don't want to miss that. Jennifer Coffendaffer, Break the Case, wherever you get podcasts, and on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe there and follow her coverage on X as well. And Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. It's Not All About Me. It's his latest book. It's available wherever books are sold and audiobook. Go check it out and leave a review. Until next time, for Jen, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.